Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're chatting with Robert Sinn, also known as Goldfinger on CEO.ca, also writes for the Energy and Gold website. Now, Robert, you're in Vancouver over the last about 2 weeks now for the conferences, a lot of metals investment focused conferences. We had Roundup, Metals Investment Forum, and the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. They all kind of tied together, and we were at a couple of them. I know you spoke at almost all of those. Look, we've already talked about it last week that the attitude was quite good. Some of the most bullish or most optimistic moods that I've seen at these resource conferences in quite a while. Now, we did see a bit of a correction at the end of the week, and sometimes mood and attitude can be a bit of a lagging indicator, but it is nice to see more optimism for the space. What were some of your takeaways from the number of different conferences that you attended?
Yeah, hey guys, thanks for inviting me on again. Corey, I think the mood of those conferences was a product of two things primarily. And one of the things, you know, my favorite expressions in markets is that sentiment follows price only all the time, right? So gold and miners in general have had a very strong January that led up to those conferences in Vancouver a week ago. And obviously that helped to raise spirits and actually increase attendance. And obviously with gold jumping from 1800 at the end of 2022 to over 1950 during that conference week, there was more optimism, and you could feel a little more energy, you know, a bit of a pep in the step. And the last time all three of those conferences were in Vancouver and in person was actually January 2020, and I think we know the world changed soon thereafter. I think back on those January 2020 conferences, especially VRIC, and definitely the mood was optimistic then as well. But I think obviously this time is a little bit different. Hopefully we're not facing a global pandemic in a couple of months that's going to shut everything down. But I will say that one of my favorite presentations at VRIC was the Ross Beaty presentation, where he called juniors a coiled spring. And he actually stated the environment is bullish for virtually all metals. I mean, it was a very optimistic and powerful presentation. And he makes a lot of sense. You know, when you consider this EV revolution that the world is undergoing and some of the forecasts for the kinds of, you know, supply of, you know, metals that we're going to need over the coming years. And there's a Scotiabank report out, you know, recently that says, you know, lithium, the world's going to need more than double, you know, the supply that exists today by 2026 to meet the EV manufacturing outlook. So, yeah, it was a good conference week, definitely more energy than I felt in a while in this sector. And I think the overall good spirits was just simply a product of the price action during the month of January across the sector.
Well, Robert, it is interesting how sentiment does follow price every time, but we did have a couple good months in a row too for the precious metals, really starting in Q4 of last year. I mean, silver bottomed very beginning of September at 1740 and then ratcheted higher. The mining stocks kind of bottomed the end of September. If you look at GDX, GDXJ, SILJ, and then gold actually bottomed in early November, got the memo and it shot higher. So we had those couple months ramping up before 2023 even kicked off, and then it carried into the beginning of the year. But then we did see, coming out of those conferences last week, a lot of chaos in the economic markets with the Fed coming out with their meeting and not throwing people the curveball that they thought they would see, but really the jobs report and the better manufacturing number being the curveball at the end of the week. What do you make of the recent volatility we've seen in price action and economic markets?
Yeah, I did a couple presentations in Vancouver during conference week, and one of them was more focused on gold technicals and sort of a chart tour. And one of the things I said is that the longer term chart structure for gold and the trend of central bank accumulation of gold is very positive. And I would not be surprised at all to see gold rise above $2,000 at some point in 2023 and maybe even make a new all-time high up of 2100 in the process. However, you know, we got up to 1975 last week, and that's a very big move in a fairly short period of time. So as a longtime gold investor and chart observer, I was not surprised to see a smackdown, maybe a little surprised by the magnitude of it, dropping $100 an ounce in basically 36 hours. But that was definitely a product of that jobs data on Friday. And I cast some doubts on the accuracy of those numbers from the BLS. I mean, the consensus forecast by economists was plus 187,000 jobs. The number came in at plus $517,000 non-farm payroll. So this is a very wide beat, probably the biggest beat I've ever seen on a non-farm payrolls number. And it calls into question how exactly they came to that number. Because if I just look at the company reports that I see, the quarterly reports that I've seen in the last few weeks, the news headlines I've seen about hiring and firing, and some data from my own experience and my own contacts in corporate America, I don't really see a massive amount of hiring with, you know, no layoffs. In fact, quite the opposite. I think a lot of companies are cutting down on their workforce a bit, maybe not, you know, in a huge way, but definitely there is some moderation and rebalancing in the labor market. So that was an odd report, and it definitely knocked gold down as the dollar rose and treasury yields rose. And we're sort of back to this 1875 level, which was actually an area of consolidation at the beginning of January. So I think bigger picture, it's a healthy reset, sort of back to a support level. We might have to go down and test, you know, an 1850 area. I would not be shocked by that. But, you know, longer term, it doesn't really change things at all.
Well, that 1850 area is right where that 50-day moving average comes in for gold. So, yeah, maybe very natural. It just did happen so, so quickly. How do you correlate the moves over in some of the resource stocks, though? Because something I noted at the tail end of last week was gold was close to testing all-time highs. It was under 10% away from all-time highs. GDX, GDXJ, silver, SIL, they were about 40% off of highs just from a couple years ago, let alone their highs from over a decade ago. Do we finally start to see some catch-up being played by the gold stocks, by silver, even by silver stocks?
Yeah, I think silver is a little bit of a different beast. And, you know, one of the points I made in my VRIC presentation was that central banks don't buy silver. So, you know, the industrial aspect of silver is a much bigger part of the price action than it is for gold. Silver was consolidating around that 24-2450 level, and obviously got smacked down along with gold last week. 22 is sort of my big sort of line in the sand support level. I really wouldn't want to see silver make a weekly close under $22 at this point. But just like with gold, it's sort of a last week has caused a reset in sentiment and a reset in the chart. So probably gather itself during the month of February and then see if we can move back up to retest that $24 area in March. As far as the juniors, juniors are a different animal. And as Ross Beaty said, he sees them as a coiled spring. And I think that's right. But the timing of when that coiled spring explodes is obviously in question. And the juniors and gold miners more broadly are affected by profit margins and rising costs across the, you know, industry. And juniors more specifically are affected by the cost of financing, which has you know, risen in the last year quite substantially. So those are negatives for the industry. And as you mentioned, the positives are that, well, gold was not, you know, was just above 1900 an ounce. That's near an all-time high. So the product that they mine is selling for a relatively high price, but obviously the costs of mining those ounces of gold have increased quite a bit. We've seen a lot of miners see their all-in costs creep up to $1,300, $1,400, even $1,500 an ounce. So they're still profitable, It's just they're also being squeezed on the cost side as well.
Yeah, Robert, that's a cogent point, because as we have seen some nice moves in the metals prices, we've also seen big moves in input costs, which kind of still compressed the margins. Still nice to see that the metals are running a little higher. That might help as inflation gets a little more muted, but it's not really the same kind of cost structure for these companies as it was even 2 years ago. Big changes. As a result, we're not seeing some of the projects that have been sitting on the shelf for a long time get built. And we had some big news this week I'd love to get your reaction to about just really over the last 24 hours that Newmont is going to be acquiring, or has had a made a bid to acquire Newcrest for a 26% premium. And this is on the back of seeing Yamana get picked off by Pan American Silver and Agnico Eagle. So these majors are still cannibalizing one another instead of going after the development projects that would take a lot of capital to build and bring online. What do you make of that in the M&A space, and could this actually get a little excitement going, or is it kind of a sign of the times as far as the kind of companies that are being acquired?
Yeah, you know, Shad, I saw that news last night when it hit the wires, and I was like, wow, that seems like a big deal, because this is a big acquisition. You know, Newmont is already the largest gold producer in the world, and so adding on the number six or number seven gold miner in the world just makes them that much larger. You know, you're looking at a combined entity with a market cap of $60 billion American, I guess. It's a pretty, you know, substantial portfolio of assets. And what really stood out to me is with, you know, Newcrest, some of their expansion in recent years has been in the Golden Triangle. They actually really have some pretty large assets there in the Golden Triangle. And so, you know, Newmont acquiring them along with their saddle project that they already had from 2021 makes them the biggest player in the Golden Triangle. And so sort of my thinking goes to, okay, so what's next? If the biggest gold miner in the world is investing in the Golden Triangle and acquiring assets there, what are the next assets that might be sort of targets? And the first one that came to my mind is Skeena. So we'll have to see if Skeena is in play. It seems like this is a big year for Skeena. Obviously, they don't really start to get out there and start to, you know, drill until around the June timeframe. But that's something that I have my eye on for sure. And it's also, I think this is still early in the M&A cycle for the gold mining sector. I feel like there's a lot more deals to come, and you have to think, well, is the number two player going to do some, you know, takeovers, you know, of its own? So that, you know, remains to be seen. And I think that one of the targets that might be interesting for Barrick would be something like a Skeena.
So to Shad's point, though, Robert, we just haven't seen these large guys move down into these development companies. They seem to be buying out each other, taking over already producing mines. I actually just put out a interview with Skeena and a recap of their exploration program last year, what they're planning on this year. But when or what finally do you think would trigger these guys to stop just consolidating with the big boys and actually buy a development play and actually build it?
That's a good question. I don't have a great answer to that. I think that by acquiring each other, they're able to move the, you know, needle a lot easier in terms of scale. And the bigger mining companies for the last decade, since they made a couple of really, or several really bad acquisitions around the 2010, 2011 timeframe, have preferred to wait for juniors to really need capital and also get to the feasibility or permitting stage for their projects. And then they tend to come in as vultures, like we saw, you know, with, you know, like Alexco and, you know, Hecla, you know, in the Yukon. So I really don't have a great answer to that question, but it's probably going to be later in the cycle. So once they've rolled up each other as much as they pretty much can, then they'll have no choice but to look down the food chain.
Well, Robert, just another thought that comes to mind when we look at M&A and these companies like the big majors growing through producers is, even if we look back the last few years, the majority of the deals that we've seen have been two mid-tier companies that were producers becoming, you know, a merger of equals, or even some of the larger producers were still picking off individual single asset producing companies. Do you think that that puts a premium on producers or smaller producers that are in a good jurisdiction that could be picked off, or are people chasing their tails hoping that their developers or that their junior advanced explorers are going to get picked off by the majors? Because we really haven't seen, other than Great Bear, we really haven't seen that many transactions in that side of the equation for years now.
Yeah, I think that the first part of your question, yes, I think the jurisdiction definitely matters. And there is a premium to be in North America or Australia. There's no doubt about that. And that premium might even expand. As far as the assets goes, I still think that if your mine generates less than 100,000 ounces a year, it's just simply not attractive to any major or even a, you know, mid-tier, you know, to be quite frank. So scale is really important, and that's going to put a premium on multi-million ounce projects. And I think when I say multi-million, I mean like 4 million or 5 million ounces, not 2 or 3 million. So the majors are definitely on the hunt for these 4 or 5 million ounce projects in good jurisdictions. There's just not a whole lot of them, but I think that's a good list to formulate is what are the juniors that have assets like that could really be attractive to a very large gold mining company.
One thing that is interesting about this deal too is Newcrest is going through a management change. The head of that company did just step away. I believe it was the tail end of last year. So the company is dealing with that management change. Robert, this all ties into a general concept where we keep hearing that, look, we're running out of feed. We're running out of supply. These majors need to take over these juniors because, well, they don't have the pipeline of assets. They're telling us a little bit different story, though, with these majors. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think the majors do have a pipeline of assets, for sure. Maybe it's not as well understood, but the majors, you know, like Newmont or, you know, Agnico definitely have a lot of work that they do on the exploration side, and they do have stakes in smaller companies for sure. So I think that the pipeline is barren is a little overstated. They definitely do a lot of exploration work, and they do have a pipeline of, you know, feasibility stage or even PEA stage projects that they, you know, work on and they have, you know, ready. And, you know, if we look at some of these companies in this environment of the last couple of years, they've only been willing to advance a couple projects at a time, just from a feasibility and a bandwidth standpoint. So these companies generally move a lot slower and they're a lot more cautious. And when they move, they move in a very, very big way with very, very large projects and new mines to build. And they focused on those, you know, so two or three at a time, maybe. And then they build those and get those operating and then they move on. So a lot of people don't understand just how long the cycles are in the mining sector and how much time it takes for these things to evolve. You know, project might be explored. You might have the first hole into it that makes a new find, and it won't be built as a mine for 15 years. You know, so these things take a lot of time, and there might be multiple cycles in terms of the macro that occur during the life cycle of a mining asset.
Well, Robert, just one more on this, because you brought up the strategic stake that a lot of the majors have in some advanced exploration plays or even some earlier stage exploration plays. You brought up also that back in 2010, 2011, 2012, a lot of these majors made bad acquisitions, growth for the sake of growth, ounces for the sake of ounces, and they got slaughtered because of it. And a lot of the CEOs lost their jobs because of it. And it was kind of a dark period where you saw all the big companies overpaying at the top of the market. What they've done over the last, let's say, decade is instead take strategic stakes in junior companies. And so a lot of juniors will get up and wave their arms and say, hey, look, Agnico or Newcrest or Newmont or Barrick or somebody has a stake in us. but it looks like they've got a stake in a lot of different plays, and it doesn't look like they're incubating all of them. It looks like they're almost just taking a stake in the exploration side of the business to play the equity side of it. What do you make of that phenomenon, and are you encouraged by majors taking stakes in juniors?
I mean, I think it is a level of validation, so it is encouraging, but it all depends upon the specific company, the project portfolio. And I mean, I think that, you know, if you think about it logically, let's say a company like, you know, Newmont with a $40 or $50 billion market cap, when they make a $5 or $10 million investment in a junior, it's really not relevant for them. It's just a sort of a toehold stake. It's something for them to build a stake in the company at a relatively low cost basis at an early stage. And they'll only advance on it and go for the whole thing if they see a lot of good results on the you know, exploration side, and feel that this is sort of time sensitive and they need to, you know, acquire it. There's very few situations like that in the mining sector. Most situations, the bigger company is willing to just simply wait for the project or projects to be advanced and for more dilution to take place. And at some point, they might pounce on that asset during the feasibility or permitting stage, which we know is a relatively challenging stage of the mining you know, life cycle, especially for a junior.
All right, Robert, let's switch focus just a little bit and touch on something that you mentioned early on in this interview, and that is lithium demand growth expectations from a recent Scotiabank report. Take us through what they think lithium could experience in terms of demand growth in the near term.
Yeah, this is a pretty compelling report. I mean, basically, the report, to sort of nail down a few points, shows that China and the European Union have sort of an insatiable, you know, insatiable hunger for EVs over the coming years. And that's going to cause the global outlook for, you know, lithium to more than double by 2026. So the supply side of the equation is going to have to really accelerate over the coming years to meet the surge of EV manufacturing, namely coming from China and the EU. So literally right now in at the end of 2022, you have about 10 million EVs globally, and that's looking to reach nearly 22 million by year end 2026. And the amount of you know, lithium that will be needed to manufacture all those EVs over the next 3 to 4 years will go from about 385,000 tons to almost 1 million tons. Basically, it's almost a 3X. It's a very, very big move. So a lot of new supply is going to have to come online. And we saw that investment by General Motors and Thacker Pass last week, $650 million. That was definitely an eye turner, because you don't see many big car companies making investments like that in mines or mining companies.
Yeah, it is nice to see some of the manufacturers get involved with the mining cycle. And we have seen a few deals like that from some of the large Asian conglomerates as well in the lithium. But I guess my question for the lithium stocks for investors would invest in this sector is, at this point, when we look back maybe 10 years ago, they're producing. Now there's about 12. And a lot of the development stage companies that are getting close, or the direct lithium extraction companies that are getting closer, if their supply comes online, that should fill the gap, even a 3X gap, based on all these projects sitting there waiting to come online. But when you look at the space, Robert, there's like 150 names in the lithium space. It seems like every week we see another gold junior that's now found some lithium on their property or some pegmatites. At what point are we at peak froth in this sector?
Well, just to keep it super simple, if you look at the, you know, lithium stock exchange traded fund on the NYSE, it has made lower highs since late 2021. So while, you know, I read the Scotiabank report and it looks very bullish and quite optimistic for the sector, the fact is that the stocks in some ways peaked at the end of 2021. And maybe that's because this exchange traded fund has Tesla as a big part of it as well. But yeah, it's like when you see a report like this that's so bullish and you see so many new companies coming to the market exploring for, you know, lithium, it definitely gives me pause. And I have to wonder if the bull case is fully priced in. And if I look at the big stocks in the sector, I'd have to say, well, the fact that they're not making new highs, you know, despite the fact that the outlook seemingly continues to improve, that's a notable divergence. And it's a divergence that I've often seen in the past, especially in like base metals, for example, when the market was sort of peaking and getting ready to roll over. So that's something that we'll definitely need to keep an eye on, but it does give me some caution in the near term.
Yeah, fair enough, Robert. We have seen these stocks just explode. And to Shad's point, a lot of these other companies that need a bit of a kick in terms of their share price in the upward direction, well, they seem to be all of a sudden finding lithium somewhere on their assets or even acquiring these assets.
Yeah.
Robert, thank you as always for your time. Great chatting with you. I enjoyed all of your talks at the conferences. So let's get you back on the show again soon so we can keep up to date with the markets, the metals, and any companies that you like. So Robert, thanks again for your time, man.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.